Good afternoon, and welcome to the TD Bank Group 2010 fourth quarter investor presentation. My name is Mushtaq Nadjirali, and I'm Vice President of Investor Relations at the bank. We'll begin today's presentation with strategic remarks by Ed Clark, the bank's CEO, followed by Colleen Johnston, the bank's CFO, who will provide an overview of operating results. Marc Chauvin, Chief Risk Officer, will then offer comments on credit quality. Following that, we'll entertain questions from those in the room today and also from pre-qualified analysts and investors over the phone. Also present today to answer your questions are Bob Dorrance, Group Head, Wholesale Banking; Tim Hockey, Group Head, Canadian Banking and Insurance; Bharat Masrani, Group Head, U.S. P&C Banking; and Mike Pedersen, Group Head, Global Wealth Management, Direct Channels, and Corporate Shared Services. Please turn to slide two. At this time, I'd like to caution our listeners that this presentation contains forward-looking statements, and there are risks that actual results could differ materially from what is discussed. Any forward-looking statements contained in the presentation represent the views of management and are presented for the purpose of assisting the bank's shareholders and analysts in understanding the bank's financial position, objectives and priorities, and anticipated financial performance, and may not be appropriate for other purposes. Certain material factors or assumptions were applied in making these forward-looking statements. For additional information on these factors and assumptions, please see our 2010 MD&A on td.com. With that, let me turn the presentation over to Ed.
Thank you, Mushtaq, and thanks everyone for joining us today. Colleen's going to be up shortly to discuss our fourth quarter results in greater detail. What I'd like to do is start by sharing my thoughts on the quarter and the year, and then provide some thoughts on how we think 2011 is shaping up. This quarter marked a good finish to what was obviously a great year for TD, with our outstanding retail franchises leading the way. Total adjusted retail earnings were $1.2 billion, up 22% over last year. Both our Canadian and U.S. personal and commercial businesses delivered double-digit growth versus last year, and our wholesale bank delivered another strong quarter. Overall, this was a strong performance compared to last year, despite the ongoing economic uncertainty. That said, there were a few items this quarter that investors and analysts could not have foreseen. Expenses in both our Canadian P&C and corporate segments were higher this quarter, and Colleen will provide some context on this later. On a fundamental basis, our underlying results were in line with our expectations and were not dissimilar to last quarter. I also want to briefly comment on a business decision we made this quarter. We reached an agreement with the Canada Revenue Agency that provides resolution to a number of previously discontinued wholesale banking strategies that had been reassessed by the CRA. This agreement resulted in a $121 million income tax expense for the quarter. I'm pleased with this outcome. It's consistent with our approach of focusing on our core franchise business. So now let me look back on 2010 in a bit more detail. It was clearly a year of significant growth for us, despite the weak economy, low interest rates, and an increasingly complex regulatory environment. Total adjusted earnings crossed the $5 billion mark for the first time. Our retail operations had record adjusted earnings of $4.8 billion, solidifying our position as a top-tier North American retail bank. Adjusted earnings per share rose 8% and are back to the record levels that we saw in 2007. That achievement is even more impressive when you consider that our share count is significantly higher, driven by shares that were issued during the economic downturn and through acquisitions. All of our franchises made strong contributions this year. TD Canada Trust had an outstanding year filled with records and industry recognition. TD Canada Trust is recognized as the leader in delivering customer service and convenience. With the introduction of seven-day banking at over 25% of our network, we continue to show our commitment to our customers and to our business model. At the same time, TD Canada Trust is a spectacular business success. In the last 10 years, it has proved to be a premier retail franchise with a tremendous growth story, and in 2010, it again produced record earnings. Our global wealth management segment had strong momentum all year long, supported by improving equity markets. Earnings are now almost back to the 2008 levels. We continue to do a great job at gathering assets as we finish the year in the number two spot in long-term mutual fund sales in the industry. We also continue to extend our leadership in the online area. We recently introduced a global trading platform which allows our clients to trade on multiple exchanges and in multiple currencies. TD Bank, America's most convenient bank, surpassed the $1 billion U.S. in adjusted earnings, a great milestone for our U.S. team. We delivered strong organic growth with the opening of 32 new stores. We grew deposits and continued to support our customers through lending. And as a result, we have taken market share. We've also grown our footprint by 23% with some key acquisitions. We like what we've seen so far from these recent additions to our franchise. We have the scale we need to compete. We'll continue to grow earnings while we navigate through the economic and regulatory headwinds that exist in the United States. After a record year in 2009, the wholesale team delivered another impressive year ahead, frankly, of our expectations, with almost $1 billion in adjusted earnings. This is a great testament to our client-focused strategy. This strong performance was achieved despite the tougher operating environment. The year reflects our philosophy, which remains the same. Invest in the businesses, run simple and transparent strategies, and focus on growth without going out the risk curve. Our success was recently recognized by Euromoney when the magazine named TD the best bank in North America for the second consecutive year. Recently, two great TD leaders have moved into advisory roles where we can continue to tap into their knowledge and wisdom. I want to thank Bernie Dorval, who headed TD Insurance, and Bill Hatanaka, who headed Global Wealth Management, for their great contributions. I look forward to getting advice from them in the future. As in the past, this great year was underpinned by TD's more than 81,000 employees who worked tirelessly to make it all happen. In a year filled with challenges and uncertainty, our team came through for our customers and our shareholders. I am very proud of everyone's contribution bank-wide and want to thank all of them on behalf of the board and the senior executive team. Our focus on customers and clients really proves you can grow your franchise, take market share, and deliver a premium growth platform despite a tough macroeconomic environment. When we look to 2011, we think it's pretty clear that the challenges and uncertainties will be continuing themes. The global economy is on the mend, thanks in large part to the swift and coordinated actions of governments and central banks around the world. But there are still major structural issues that remain unresolved, and the recovery has been sluggish. Challenges such as the U.S. housing crisis and global trade imbalances are undermining investor and consumer confidence about the future. They're also acting as a drag on recovery. Everyone's eyes are drawn to the macroeconomic environment, which continues to be weak and uncertain. Compared to a quarter ago, our outlook for the global economy has become more negative, largely because of the debt crisis affecting much of Europe. We've said before we aren't worried about direct sovereign risk to TD, but what makes us cautious is the potential impact of this crisis on the global economic recovery. However, on the ground at the operational level, our businesses and our clients are telling us conditions are actually improving. Still, most expect interest rates to remain low. At the same time, we don't expect declining PCLs to provide the same degree of tailwind that we saw in 2010. We're also facing a cooler housing market in Canada and the impact of new regulations in the United States, which have already impacted our fee-based revenue. But despite all this doom and gloom, I have to tell you that our outlook for 2011 has not become more negative. As I said, our on-the-ground view is anything, if anything, is actually more positive. I'm confident that we have the team, the experience, and the strategy in place to manage through these challenges and continue to outperform. Let me say a few words about the proposed capital and liquidity rules, as I know they're on your mind. Let me start with liquidity. As you know, we've always been very prudent in managing our liquidity. We can easily meet the proposed rules immediately. As for capital, there are many moving parts, and so we can't actually give you precise estimates until we get clarity on certain items. But I can tell you a few things. We have a strong capital position at 12.2% today and a proven ability to generate capital from operating businesses. We will increase dividends in line with earnings growth over time, and I'll come back to that issue. The new market risk rules come into effect at the end of December 2011. Our market risk is expected to be 3 to 4 times the current level of $4.5 billion. Our move to Basel II in the United States is a positive factor for us, while the move to IFRS will have a negative impact. Both numbers, unfortunately, are still preliminary, and we can't be more precise. Our risk-weighted assets will increase due largely to the counterparty credit risk, RWA, that's related to derivative counterparties. Again, there are still some relevant details to be finalized before we can comfortably comment on the impact. What we do know is that the deductions for substantial investments will impact TD due to the size of our TD Ameritrade investment. We'll get some basket relief for the deductions, which grow as the tangible common equity grows. We presently disclose all the items that you need to reasonably calculate the impact on this front. What's important to keep in mind here is that even if we use conservative estimates for all the moving parts, we feel very confident that we will not need to issue capital in order to meet the proposed rules. The real question is how much excess capital we will have. We need more clarity on the final rules and guidelines before we can be definitive about the exact amount. But I know there's another issue that investors and analysts would like us to address. Can we meet the proposed rules in 2013 without the benefit of the phase-in deductions? The fact that we can meet that test, and we can, doesn't mean we should tell you that we will. We don't think the industry should be working towards a higher level capital standard than agreed to in the proposed rules. Canadian banks are already well capitalized, have strong organic growth engines, and have already displayed the ability to manage through a major economic crisis. Ultimately, it is not in the best interest of investors for us to hold all of this excess capital and not benefit from the globally approved phase-in of deductions. Clearly, holding all that capital upfront would have a negative impact on shareholder returns. It would also not be helpful from a public policy perspective if the industry led an arms race to self-impose guidelines more severe than the current proposed rules. There is a real risk that by pushing on this target, the industry will force regulators to adopt this as a new target. While it may feel good to state the obvious, that clearly Canadian banks could go faster towards these rules than European banks, is it really helpful today to solving the issues that exist in Europe to unilaterally have Canada declare a higher test than the carefully negotiated balanced solution that we now have? In addition, from a North American perspective, it's hard for me to see the advantage of overcapitalizing our banking system. This will come at the cost of reducing our ability to support loan growth or alternatively buying franchises like South Financial Riverside, where we've been able to unlock the lending arms of these institutions to better support their customers and clients. Finally, as I said, I want to reiterate that our dividend policy is linked to the board's outlook on long-term sustainable earnings rather than on capital levels. As we've said before, we hope to be in a better position to give you some guidance during our first quarter 2001 earnings call. 2011 will definitely be a challenging and uncertain year, but in a sense, we've all become used to that. We've continued to deliver sustainable long-term growth and have consistently proved that our strategy of focusing on high-quality, reliable, lower-risk retail earnings is the right one. And we remain committed to delivering 7 to 10% adjusted EPS growth, or delivering our 7 to 10% adjusted EPS growth target over the medium term, as we have done in the past. As to 2011, we expect that we can at least meet this goal. With that, let me wrap up. We had a good quarter, which capped off a great year. Our Canadian P&C business performed extremely well, even as we've seen a moderation of volume growth. Our U.S. P&C business delivered strong results despite macroeconomic and regulatory challenges. I'm confident we've built a competitive U.S. growth platform that's focused on long-term profitability. Wholesale delivered strong results that frankly surpassed our expectations, and wealth management continued to build on its momentum. I'm truly proud of TD and its many successes in 2010, and we are looking forward to good results in 2011. So now let me turn this over to Colleen.
Thanks, Ed, and good afternoon. Let's start with the full year review. Please turn to slide 3. 2010 total bank adjusted net income was $5.2 billion, up 11% from last year, and adjusted EPS was $5.77, up 8% year over year. Our 2010 results are a testament to the franchise earnings power of our retail businesses in both Canada and the United States. In total, our retail businesses delivered total adjusted earnings of $4.8 billion, up 20% over 2009, and a new record. Retail earnings were 83% of total bank earnings. TD Canada Trust had a record year right across the board, delivering $3.1 billion in earnings, up 25% over 2009. Revenue growth was strong at 10%. Volume growth was excellent. We took market share. The margin was stable, and we had 6 points of operating leverage while investing in the business. Credit losses declined. Another excellent year for TD Canada Trust. A strong year for wealth management. Our Canadian retail business delivered $447 million in earnings, up 30% from last year. Revenue growth was strong at 11%. Operating leverage was good at 4 points. And assets continued to grow through new client assets and better markets. U.S. P&C finished the year on a high note, delivering over U.S. $1 billion in earnings, up 29%. Despite regulatory changes and a tough economy, we saw 13% revenue growth and improved credit losses. We added 245 high-quality branches to our U.S. footprint this year through acquisitions and de novo growth. Wholesale banking had a very strong year with earnings of almost $1 billion, down 13% from the record performance we saw in 2009. We posted another year of 30-plus percent return on invested capital. Corporate segment loss was $537 million on an adjusted basis, up 35% from 2009, mainly due to higher unallocated corporate expenses. Tier 1 capital ratio continues to be strong at 12.2% and was up 90 basis points due to strong retained earnings growth. Looking back to our performance this year, here are some of the things that come to mind. We had very strong top-line growth and 4% operating leverage for the bank, excluding wholesale. The credit environment has improved, and our adjusted credit losses declined $540 million, or 24% compared to last year. These improvements were partially offset by a few items. First, our wholesale earnings normalized in line with our expectations. Second, our results were negatively impacted by a higher effective tax rate compared to last year due to declining benefits from our tax structures and lower favorable tax adjustments. Finally, the strengthening of the Canadian dollar reduced earnings by $171 million, or 20 cents per share. Overall, we are very pleased with the year. Please turn to slide 4. Q4 2010 highlights: total bank adjusted net income of $1,260 million, down 3% from last quarter and 4% compared to Q4 of 09. Adjusted diluted EPS for the quarter, $1.38, down 3% over last quarter and down 5% over last year. The key highlight this quarter was yet another strong performance in our retail businesses, which contributed $1.2 billion in adjusted earnings, up 22% from last year. Both our Canadian and U.S. retail businesses delivered double-digit growth compared to last year. Credit quality was generally stable in the quarter, but PCLs increased quarter over quarter in wholesale and in U.S. P&C. The wholesale segment delivered a strong quarter, adjusted net income of $216 million, down 42% over Q4 of last year, but up 21% from last quarter. The corporate segment loss declined by $19 million compared to last quarter, but increased by $109 million compared to last year. Tier 1 capital ratio of 12.2% was down 30 basis points from last quarter, mainly due to the closing of the South Financial transaction, partially offset by retained earnings growth. Please turn to slide 6. Reported net income of $994 million, or $1.07 per share, adjusted net income of $1,260 million, or $1.38 per share. Difference between reported and adjusted results was due to five items of note, four of which you've seen before. As Ed noted earlier, the last item of note relates to an agreement we reached with the Canada Revenue Agency, which resulted in a $121 million tax charge for the quarter. This agreement reflects a business decision to resolve certain wholesale tax exposures related primarily to previously discontinued strategies. Please turn to slide 7. Canadian P&C. Net income of $773 million, up 24% from last year, and down 8% from last quarter's record performance. Highlights. Revenue up 10% over last year, primarily due to strong volume growth in real estate secured lending, financing services, personal and business deposits, and insurance. Compared to last year, real estate secured lending volume was up 10%, and consumer loans were up 11%. Commercial loan volume increased 5%. Personal deposits increased by 5%, while business deposit volume was up 12%. We're starting to see rates of loan growth moderate, but overall growth was still 9% this quarter. This marks the first time in 15 quarters where loan growth was below 10% on a year-over-year basis. Revenue was relatively flat compared to last quarter. Compared to last year, the margin was up 3 basis points to 291, as higher margins in real estate secured lending were partially offset by margin compression in deposits and lower mortgage breakage revenue. Margin was stable compared to last quarter. Insurance revenue was up compared to last year due to robust client and premium revenue growth. Strong underlying business growth combined with improving margins will improve momentum in this business going forward. Provision for credit losses, $239 million, down 24% from last year, mainly due to better credit conditions resulting from an improving economic and employment environment. PCLs were flat to last quarter. Business banking loan losses were $18 million this quarter, down 47% from last year. Expenses were up 9% compared to last year and last quarter. The expense increase versus last quarter was largely due to project-related costs, including a project cancellation and the timing of business investment initiatives. In a few minutes, I'll talk about our outlook on expenses. Going forward, we still expect strong bottom-line growth, but not at the same rate we saw this year. Overall, a strong quarter for TD Canada Trust. Please turn to slide 8, Global Wealth Management, which excludes TD Ameritrade. Net income of $118 million, up 22% from last year, and up 1% sequentially. We've seen improving performance in this business for a seventh straight quarter. Year-over-year, higher earnings were largely driven by fee revenue from higher client assets and increased net interest margin. Revenue of $639 million increased $52 million, or 9% from the prior year, primarily due to higher assets, which drove strong fee-based revenue growth in the advice-based and asset management businesses. Expenses of $468 million increased 5% from last year, primarily due to higher variable compensation and trailer fees driven by increased revenue from higher asset levels and higher investment to support business growth. TD Ameritrade contributed $33 million to TD this quarter, down 44% from last year and 47% from last quarter. The year-over-year decrease was primarily due to the lower earnings at TD Ameritrade and the translation of effect of a stronger Canadian dollar. On the whole, a solid performance from Global Wealth. Please turn to slide 9. U.S. Personal and Commercial Bank. In U.S. dollars, adjusted net income of $275 million for the quarter, up 40% from last year and flat sequentially. The U.S. P&C segment continued its strong performance despite the lingering headwinds in the U.S. economy. The operating returns in this business continue to be strong at over 26% this quarter. Revenues of $1.2 billion were up 14%. Excluding the impact of acquisitions, revenue growth was 8% compared to last year, driven by growth in loan and deposit volumes and wider product spreads. Again, excluding acquisitions, revenue was down 3% compared to last quarter, mainly due to the impact of Regulation E on fee revenue, which came in the range of $40 to $50 million as expected. Compared with the fourth quarter last year, average loan volumes were up 13%, and deposits were up 17%. Excluding acquisitions and TD Ameritrade deposits, loan volumes were up 6%, and core deposits were up 8%. Deposit growth has been driven by maturing stores and store optimization initiatives. Volume growth compares very favorably to our peers in the United States. Expenses. Excluding the impact of the acquisitions, adjusted expenses were up 7% compared to last year due to new store expenses and investments in infrastructure expenses were relatively flat compared to last quarter. Provision for credit losses, down 29% compared to last year, but up 13% sequentially. Mark will talk more about the sequential increase we saw in debt securities classified as loans. Margin on average earning assets increased by 3 basis points to 350 compared with the prior quarter, primarily due to higher loan spreads. On the whole, another strong quarter in U.S. P&C, given the tough operating environment. Please turn to slide 10, wholesale. Adjusted net income of $216 million, a strong performance for the period. Results were down 42% from last year, but up 21% from last quarter. Last year's results reflected very strong, broad-based performance driven by the unprecedented rate of recovery of the global financial system, improving asset valuation, and market liquidity. We did expect normalization in the operating environment, which we've been seeing for the past couple of quarters. During the current quarter, credit spreads tightened, which drove improved credit valuations as compared to losses in the prior quarter, where concern over European sovereign debt dampened the markets. Provision for credit losses, PCL for the quarter, was $39 million higher than the prior quarter. We had a single merchant banking loss this quarter, whereas last quarter we saw net recoveries. Expenses. Compared to last year, expenses were down 7%, mainly due to lower variable compensation that was partially offset by higher operating costs related to investment in risk and control infrastructure. Overall, wholesale results in the second half of the year returned to more normalized levels and are more reflective of what we expect to see going forward. Please turn to slide 11. On an adjusted basis, the corporate segment posted a loss of $163 million compared with a loss of $54 million last year. Compared to the same quarter last year, the segment had an increased loss due to higher net corporate expenses and the impact of favorable tax-related items last year, partially offset by favorable hedging and treasury activities this quarter. I want to pause for a minute and comment specifically on the topic of expenses this quarter. You'll note that total bank Q4 adjusted expenses were up $278 million, or 10%, compared to last quarter. While it's normal to see a sequential increase in fourth quarter expenses, this year we're seeing a larger increase, mainly in the Canadian P&C and corporate segments. Canadian P&C costs were up $109 million over last quarter, due in part to unusual items that included costs related to a project cancellation and a depreciation accounting change. The remaining increase was due to timing of marketing and other project-related costs, or spend was higher this quarter. Corporate segment expenses increased by $127 million over last quarter. We recognized a $22 million after-tax charge related to a write-down in SimCorp, the back-office check processor owned equally by TD, RBC, and BMO. The remainder of the increase was due to elevated risk and control-related costs, higher project spend, and timing of allocations to our businesses. We've included a slide on expenses in the appendix in case you want more detail. Let me comment on our outlook for expenses. Our 2011 plan calls for more moderate levels of expense growth given some softening of top-line growth. Excluding wholesale, our operating leverage was greater than 3% in 2010. We expect that number will still be positive, but somewhat lower in 2011. With that, I will turn the presentation over to Mark.
Thank you, Colleen, and good afternoon, everyone. Please turn to slide 12. Similar to last quarter, I'll limit my comments to highlights of our credit performance and a brief update on our debt securities portfolio. The detailed credit slides continue to be provided in the appendix. I would like to remind you that the information provided is presented on a credit portfolio basis versus the financial results, which are presented on a business segment basis. The primary difference is the inclusion of U.S. credit cards in the U.S. credit portfolio. As in the past, we've excluded the impact of the debt securities classified as loans to provide a clear picture of U.S. credit portfolio performance. Please note that the $1.9 billion in FDIC-covered loans are not captured in any of the credit metrics included in this credit review. Overall, credit performance was stable in the quarter and in line with our expectations. Credit performance in the Canadian portfolios remained strong with nothing material to report. The U.S. P&C portfolio continued to perform well within our expectations given recent and current economic conditions. Default and loss rates across the U.S. personal portfolio were stable relative to the third quarter. Volume growth is concentrated in higher quality areas as we continue to benefit from mortgage refinancings. Gross impaired loans increased due to a small number of larger loans. The increase in non-residential commercial real estate was partially offset by a decrease in residential commercial real estate. The increase noted during the quarter is not considered to represent a trend or reason for concern. We have reviewed the mortgage foreclosure issue facing many major U.S. banks and do not believe it will have a material impact on our businesses. We are seeing some encouraging signs in new commercial credit originations in both Canada and the U.S. Assuming we don't experience renewed economic deterioration, we expect to see continued improvement across all credit portfolios in 2011. Lastly, I'd like to comment on the performance of our debt securities portfolio. Each quarter, we calculate the expected loss on the portfolio and assess the adequacy of the allowance. This quarter, we also included the potential impact of the mortgage foreclosure issue on valuations of securities within the portfolio, and based on this analysis, we do not believe that any adjustments are required at this time. The significant reduction in new impaired formations from prior levels and the nominal increase in the allowance were in line with our expectations for the quarter. We remain comfortable that debt securities portfolio is adequately provisioned. Now I'll turn the presentation back to Mushtaq.
Thank you, Mark. So with that, we'll open up for questions. To give everyone a chance to participate, I'd ask everyone to limit their questions to one and then please re-queue. For those of you that are participating in person, if I can ask you to please identify your name and your firm before asking your question, that would be much appreciated. Before ending the call today, I'll ask Ed to offer some final remarks. So with that, let's get started. First in the room, why don't we start there? Michael?
Okay. Michael Goldberg, Desjardins Securities. So I just want to follow up on some numbers. First of all, from the sub-pack, the lower service charges this quarter, was that Reg E in the U.S. largely?
Yes, it was.
Okay. And you also note in the expense slide the depreciation accounting change. Can you quantify that?
Michael, that charge is about $15 million a quarter, and you can't trust.
Okay. And one other more general question related to the dividend. Why did you choose not to flow through the Ameritrade dividend that you'll receive now to your own shareholders?
Because we're still operating at the upper end of our dividend payout ratio, and we keep telling you the way we run our dividend policy has nothing to do with capital movements, and we regard the dividend from Ameritrade as essentially a capital movement. The way we look at it is we're going to look forward and say, what do we believe the clear, sustainable earnings are? And when we see that we will be well within our range, then we will move on the dividend.
Thanks.
We'll move to the next question.
Thanks. John Rucastle from BMO Capital Markets. Question for Ed. You asked your own question of we should ask you how much excess capital you have under the new rules, and you didn't really answer it, so I guess I'm going to try. Do you have, if the Basel III rules were put in today as proposed and you had to meet them by Q1 2013, would you have any excess capital, or what type of capital, Christian, would you have? I understand you're...
Just to make sure I understand, I think if you're asking the question that I pose, if we said that voluntarily Canada said, we'll scrap Basel III, we're going to Basel IV, and we're going to bring forward all of the deductions to 2013, do we believe we can meet that test? And the answer is yes, we would have excess capital.
Okay, that's good.
But I keep saying, you in the industry, you keep asking that question and you'll eventually get your wish, and Canada will adopt that as its new rule, and I can't understand why investors would want to do that, but you'll have to explain that to me at some point.
Yeah, maybe I'll take that offline. But question for Tim Hockey. Just what we've heard slower loan growth in Canada, so what does that mean to you, and can spreads stay flat if long-term interest rates stay where they are?
So on the loan growth issue, as you say, we are slowing down, although we're at the high end of single digits. So we expect to be in the mid-range of single digits by this time, next year, if you will. And can spreads stay flat? We believe that we will see margins essentially on margins overall to basically bump around the level, maybe a little bit of dip. No question, competitive pressure is increasing, but that's our expectation on the outlook for the rest of the year.
Thanks, John. Next question. Darko?
Hi. Just a couple questions. It's Darko from Cormark. Colleen, can you just talk a little bit about you took the one charge for the tax change at wholesale.
Mm-hmm.
Should our forward tax assumption for TD now change as a result of that?
No, it shouldn't. So if you look at our current adjusted effective tax rate, in the quarter we were at about 20%. I think you should be looking to an effective tax rate in probably somewhere in the 20 to 25% range going forward. But it doesn't have any, that item does not have any effect on the tax rate going forward.
That's helpful. And then just a couple of other number questions as well. With respect to the expenses, some of these, the project cancellation you highlight in your notes of $26 million sort of after tax, does that imply that you canceled a project that would have been ongoing? $26 million, or is it a one-time cost in this quarter?
It was a one-time cost in this quarter, and essentially reflects a cost that had previously been capitalized, where when we canceled the project, we wrote it off. That was about $26 million.
I see. Okay. And then finally, can you just talk to the tax rate intersegment-wise within the U.S. as to what occurred there in the quarter that allowed you to produce earnings that were flat quarter over quarter?
Yeah, we had a bit of a swing in the tax line on a quarter-over-quarter basis. We actually had a tax charge in the third quarter, and we actually had an adjustment that went the other way in the fourth quarter. So that swing was about $20 million, a quarter-over-quarter, a positive change quarter-over-quarter.
Okay. Thank you. Maybe just one last housekeeping question.
We don't look at taxes as allowing us to do anything on earnings. They're simply a fact to deal with.
Bad choice of words. One last housekeeping question, Colleen. Maybe it's for you. The corporate segment, very large loss this year. I think last quarter you alluded to perhaps finding a way to better allocate corporate. Are we to expect something like of that nature in Q1?
Yes, Darko, that's still underway. And so what we'll do in Q1, when we announce our Q1 results, is you will see some movement of items out of the corporate segment into the businesses, and we will clearly lay out that impact to each of the businesses and, again, the impact on corporate segments. So look for that in Q1.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Darko. We'll move to the next question in the room. John?
I guess falling under the banner of law of unintended consequences, with the move on the new capital ratios, obviously there's a negative impact. You're going to have to hold more capital because of your ownership of Ameritrade. Does this factor into your ownership levels or what your strategic plan is, moving timelines backwards or forwards? Can you comment on that, please, Ed?
Yeah, no, not really. I think those kind of moves you should do on strategic basis, but there's the simple fact in the case of our ownership of TD Ameritrade that we have a shareholders agreement that goes to 2016, and we have a minority shareholder that loves his stake in TD Ameritrade. And so even if I had thoughts, which I don't, but if I did, doesn't matter anyway. So I think we're quite happy to stay where we are.
Thank you.
Thanks, John. Any other questions in the room? Okay, operator, we have some calls on the line. Can we take the first call, please?
Your first question comes from Robert Sedran from CIBC. Please go ahead.
Hi there. Good afternoon. Just wanted to ask about this mortgage foreclosure issue that's ongoing in the U.S. I gather the direct impact to TD is minimal. If you could confirm that, that'd be great. And then is there any indirect impact that could increase costs or just more regulatory noise as you look to grow in the residential mortgage business?
So I'll certainly take the first part of the question. When the mortgage foreclosure issues surfaced, we did an analysis, and I think the major areas that could potentially impact it is our normal foreclosure process. So we went through that, and we were satisfied that that would not be an impact. Then the second issue would be in the non-agency collateral mortgages. And the issue there was whether if the foreclosure issue slowed the market down for an extended period of time and had an impact of further reducing house prices, what would that have on our overall portfolio? So we factored that into our analysis of stress testing, and the conclusion was that while it could have some impact, we felt that it was within the range that we currently provisioned, so we're quite comfortable with that. Now, on the other side, I guess there is an issue that in the securities, if there's class action lawsuits, you might gain from them because to putting them back to an organization. We haven't seen anything that would be directly applicable to us now, but we would continue to follow that. And the other area would be whether we sold mortgages into situations that could be put back to us. But again, that was a small business in the legacy bank, so we really don't feel that's an issue.
Robert, this is Barrett. With respect to your second part of your question on is there an impact going forward, we don't think so. The rules are pretty clear as to how you process mortgages in the U.S. I'm not aware of any proposal to change those rules. So based on the information we have today, this should have no impact on our doing our mortgage business going forward.
Thank you, Rob. Operator, we'll take the next question on the line, please.
Your next question comes from Steve Theriault from Merrill Lynch Canada. Please go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Question for Mark. How much credit improvement do you think we should expect to see in 2011? Unemployment's looking pretty sticky. Credit card losses actually looked like they ticked up a touch in the quarter after a few consecutive quarters of improvement for you. Can you talk a little bit about your outlook for Canadian credit over the next, call it 12 months, and where you see losses eventually bottoming out this cycle, given your loan mix? Is it 40? Is it 35 basis points? How good can it get? Thanks.
Yeah, certainly. From a Canadian perspective, I mean, if you look at the three major credit portfolios, the Canadian commercial portfolio is very strong, has had a historically low loss rate. I think we might. I think it's going to continue to be a strong portfolio. but it wouldn't be unusual to see a slight uptick there, but nothing material, only because it's starting from such a strong position. The same argument would be for the wholesale portfolio. The one loss incurred in the fourth quarter was on a runoff portfolio, but if you look at the full-year losses in the wholesale portfolio, it's essentially flat. We feel we have a strong portfolio, and I'm not worried about it, but, you know, it is credit losses, and there could be something, so it could up a little bit, but nothing that I'd be concerned about. If you look at the Canadian consumer, I think we feel that it's getting to a point where it is reaching a pre-recession level from a normalization perspective on a larger portfolio. So from a basis point perspective, we're not looking for material gains, and you just have to factor that back into the side. So I wouldn't look for a significant improvement there because I think it's in quite a good position to start. In the U.S., as I mentioned in my comments, there we do feel that there will be improvement through into 2011.
And what was the loss in the runoff book that you mentioned?
In the wholesale, that was the $15 million. That was the wholesale loss in the fourth quarter. It was the merchant portfolio that we started running off about 2 years ago.
Thank you, Mark. Operator, we'll take the next question from the line, please.
Your next question comes from Gabriel Deschaine from Credit Suisse. Please go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Just one housekeeping item here. The $118 million in other non-interest income, does that contain any gains on credit derivatives, and is that somehow tied to any of your credit experiences this quarter?
That item is, those are treasury-related items that are booked in the corporate segment. So that was a net positive in the quarter. As I mentioned, though, our unallocated costs were up quite a bit, hence the fact that the corporate segment there was some improvement, but not a significant improvement. So those were kind of the two moving parts.
Unallocated costs and an unallocated benefit, is that?
Correct.
Okay. Just the outlook, trying to decipher some of your comments here. 2009 banks and TD being one of them, you benefited a great deal from a big surge in trading revenues this year. It was the year of credit improvement. Not hearing much bullish commentary on either one of those for 2011. What's it got to be to move the needle? Asset growth and margin expansion? Margin expansion, I guess. Tim kind of commented on that, but what's the outlook? Is it asset growth, I guess? And do you think you're going to generate healthy asset growth in 2011?
Why don't we start with Barrett and say, how come you're going to earn more next year than you earned this year?
Yeah, there you go.
Excellent management, Ed. it is the end of the year.
Yeah. So. he's got his review at the end of this meeting, so he's very nervous.
Great question. I'd say, we've got good momentum. We do have good loan growth in our bank, although the macro headwinds are pretty stiff. As you probably know, general loan growth in the U.S. is negative, but we've been able to, take share. Because of our footprint, because of the model we run, service and convenience, because of our rating, because of our strong liquidity. And so we've had, quite good growth and in the segments that we think are favorable to us. So residential mortgages, for example, we had a very small base. So you have a huge uptick in the refi activity, which we've been able to take advantage of. These are our customers that were not having their mortgages with us previously and now are. So we've been able to grow that book. So I see good momentum in volume growth and hopefully it can offset, some of the macro headwinds that we have. And secondly, in the U.S., we talked about this at our investor day. We are in the process of optimizing our platform and our business where we will look at a higher cross-sell. We've had a good start to it, and I expect, improvements over the year. So overall, I'd say the fundamentals in the business should drive, the increase that we've talked about. Now, having said that, you know, could the macro situation turn out to be, you know, hugely different than what we are experiencing now? If it does, then we'll have to find other ways of managing through it. But I feel over time, you know, the banks in the U.S. have been able to adjust their models to fit the environment that they're operating in.
And sorry, Ed, quick one. Payout ratio target range?
On the dividends? We haven't changed. It's 35 to 45%.
Okay.
Bob, do you want to comment on it? I don't know whether you're letting these guys off the hook. I thought we had them nailed the here.
I think the difficulty, obviously, in forecasting our sector is it's significantly macro-driven, so I'm not going to get into that. Talked about that before. But we have taken advantage, I think, of the last 3 years to invest in the earnings power of all parts of the business. So, depending on what the environment allows, I feel we have greater earnings power. We've invested in our rates business in a significant way in New York and the U.S. side. We have a U.S. Treasury business that has been growing and starting to produce money. We've built out a precious metals trading business that we're turning on the key probably next week. We've invested in the relationship that we have with TD Bank, America's most convenient bank. We have lots of opportunities there to grow in line with them on their businesses. And we've significantly added to our investment banking business in Canadian base, but with global initiatives around energy and mines and metals. So we've added talent, upgraded talent, and continued to mature talent in that area, and that will drive revenue in the overall banking franchise. So I think the earnings power of the dealer is significantly better than it was in 2007. Markets will determine when that comes to fruition in terms of when we actually realize the earnings.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, so in terms of wealth, I think what we've said is that we expect to deliver a record year in earnings, so over $501 million. That was predicated on two things, reasonably stable markets, and then secondly, some moderate interest rate rises in the second half of the year. Not so sure the
latter will happen, but I actually feel pretty good at this time. We're bringing in net new money. We're investing in products and advisors and in our technology. We continue to bring in new accounts, so very hopeful we can still do that.
So that delay gave me a chance to make lots of notes about all the growth opportunities we have. So 21 new branches in 2010, and we're planning on 25 in 2011. We also made lots of investments in 2010 in new commercial bankers, about 150. We had about almost 20% to our mobile mortgage specialists. So I guess the point being that we're quite confident that with that plus, as was mentioned earlier, our announcement of opening up 300 branches on Sunday for growth opportunities and to better serve our customers, we're feeling quite confident about our growth aspects in 2011. And to answer a question that's been floating around, obviously, around the expense growth, as Colleen said, clearly there was some one-time items in the quarter, and I guess what you're really looking for is are we confident that we haven't established a new step function increase in expense run rate, and the answer to that is absolutely yes. And even if revenue growth rate comes down, we are very confident that we can bring our expense growth rate down commensurate to still have good operating leverage in the year.
Just to finish up, insurance?
Yeah, I'd say on the insurance front, we're quite confident that there is very strong underlying fundamentals and that it's poised for quite a significant uptick in 2011.
So just to provide a summary, as I was alluding to in my remarks, I mean, I think we feel kind of this odd feeling that, you know, if you look at the world, I think you have to feel more nervous about the world than you felt 6 months ago. And so you have all of these big structural issues around the world, whether it's the trade imbalance with China, it's the housing, it's the fiscal problems in the U.S., and then obviously the sovereign crisis in Europe. And yet, when we talk to our operators and we get down to the ground, people today would be more optimistic than they were a quarter ago. And so you have this disjunction of whether, you know, which of these things are going to prevail, and I don't think we can tell you that, but certainly on the ground, we're quite pleased with what we're seeing, how our operating businesses are actually operating.
Thanks, Ed. Operator, can we please move to the next call?
Your next question comes from Peter Routledge from National Bank Financial. Please go ahead.
Thanks. Hi. Just a question on your deposit business in the U.S. You've got quite a healthy run-up in deposits from TD Ameritrade. How inexpensive are those deposits? Do they price like just core deposits from your retail network, and how are they likely to price in a rising rate environment? That'd be the first question.
So the pricing of those deposits is with TD Ameritrade. You know, it's a TD Ameritrade decision as to how they price it, but I think historically they've shown that they're able to grow that book and consistently, and it seems to be quite stable. But, you know, exactly what their pricing strategies might be, you know, I think it's more appropriate for TD Ameritrade to answer. As far as, you know, the bank is concerned, you know, we manage those deposits for them. We manage it for a very nominal fee and are happy to do that. And they fit within TD Bank Financial Group's treasury strategies.
Yeah, we've been public is that, you know, we pay them LIBOR minus 25, and they set the LIBOR duration, and then they price raising the deposits whatever they want to, but most of those deposits are low to no interest paying deposits to them.
And that money has to be, you know, it's brokerage money. Could it run off as quickly as it's come on in a healthier economy when people maybe looking to get back in the market?
Our experience is that it's remarkably sticky. Their franchise is heavily an active trader franchise, and traders may not be well known, but they actually keep a remarkable amount of cash, and they're relatively indifferent to what they're getting paid on the cash, because the cash is there to do trades. And so our experience is that quite a proportion of them, we obviously watch quite closely, as we do everywhere in the bank, you know, what do we think the elasticity of those deposits are to interest rates, and how fast could they move on. But a remarkable proportion are quite sticky.
Okay. And then on the government side, which is, I guess, $13 billion, I mean, normally I guess this wouldn't be an issue, but the states do have cash flow challenges potentially ahead of them, one of which I'm sure will be possibly New Jersey. Any signs or concerns that you might have, you know, a bit of a, not so much a runoff, but just, you know, cash going out to support the state's operating budgets?
I'd say generally, you know, we have been redoing and re-energizing our government banking business to ensure that we are only attracting the type of business that is more relationship-oriented, where we are not the shop for, you know, hot money, because, you know, we don't have an interest in that. I think, you know, our group has done a reasonable job. Our growth in government deposits has not been as robust as the rest of the book, and I think that is fine as far as I'm concerned. And your question on, you know, as these state governments or municipalities are stretched, and are they going to run this down? These are more operating type of funds, Peter. Maybe they will. I cannot say for sure. But we've seen, you know, these are relatively stable, and the issue of, you know, how much we keep and how much we grow depends on our strategy of whether we want to pursue a relationship with a particular state or a particular municipality. But I have not seen, you know, rundown of these deposits for the reason that you just cited.
Just last question on the CRE portfolio, commercial real estate. I see your construction portfolio, at least non-accruals, tend to be trending down, but just your normal or regular commercial mortgage non-accruals tend to be rising as a percent of loans outstanding. Is this just something that will take another year or two to work through? And, you know, is there any hockey stick coming that you're worried about?
It's Mark. Yeah, as you point out, the riskier portfolio, the residential real estate, is trending down. I mean, I think we're at the end of that. In terms of the CRE, we did expect it to come up. It's lagging the other portfolios, you would expect. But we're really not looking for a hockey stick. We've been concerned about that portfolio for a while, and it's continued to pleasantly surprise us, and I think it will continue that it's weathering the economic period quite well. And we don't look for a, in fact, you know, as we look at these loans, we try to, you know, look at what loans are vulnerable and kind of get as much of a picture ahead of time. And that doesn't, it's not showing us any warning, significant warning signals or anything that would be contradicting our view that we think it'll start to recede and go down in 2011.
Thanks. That's it.
Thanks, Mark. Operator, can we please take the next call?
Your next question comes from Sumit Malhotra from Macquarie Capital Markets. Please go ahead.
Thanks very much. Firstly, on Ed's comments on capital, I think one of the reasons the market has been so focused on ensuring that the banks can get to the proposed levels as quickly as possible, which, as you suggested, seems to be the end of 2012, is that the comments from the local regulator, OSFI, when they followed up Basel, seem to indicate that any capital deployment moves that banks wanted to make, be it acquisitions, dividends, buybacks, had to take into account meeting those requirements and any market requirements that may come on top of that. So I guess the question I'd put to you, you told us you're pretty sure you would have excess capital at that period of time, but how does that impact your thought process on potential acquisition opportunities that may arise for you in the U.S., especially since it seems like the pricing environment has been getting beneficial in that regards again?
Well, obviously, the extent to which I have excess capital, then I can do them. In other cases, if it turns out that the regulatory rules say I can't, I don't have excess capital, then I'm going to have to issue shares for them. And the discipline of having to issue shares is not a bad thing. You want to make sure when you look at an acquisition that you, even if you use cash, that it would be a good acquisition if you, in fact, had issued shares to do it. My only point is we have a set of rules. I think the regulators around the world are reading the markets as wanting people to move faster. And I don't understand why that's in the interest of the shareholders to do that. And as I say, I am very concerned that if we get into this, I always have more capital than you, and we keep raising the test higher and higher, we're putting a lot of capital into the banks that is not going to be very productive and isn't actually necessary to make them safe. And the consequence of that is that banks are going to either lend less or they'll buy other corporations. And as you know, in the United States, there are a number of banks sitting there not capable of serving their clients because they don't have the capital base to do that. So I'm just concerned that the market is building this. The regulator is responding to what they see as market pressure to actually go to a Basel IV. And I don't understand why the market wants people to go to even higher tests. That's the part that I'm mystified, but John's going to tell me after this call why that's the case.
Well, I certainly understand where that's coming from. I look at your two largest competitors in Canada who have recently undertaken transactions. And look, everybody has a different strategy, but obviously their transactions are very low RWA-related in nature. And as I think this most recent deal that you closed added about $8 billion. So, you know, the thinking becomes here, you've talked about almost the fact that almost any deal you do price-wise now is going to be something that should be beneficial to your ROIC. And I think where I'm getting at here is, will you be somewhat handcuffed from taking advantage of those opportunities because of the capital position?
You can see that there's even more than me that dislikes your question. Just to repeat what I'm saying, we have a reasonable set of unknowns. It may be that other people don't have unknowns, but we do not know today what the final impact of IFRS is. We don't know what the impact of moving the U.S. to Basel II is. We don't know the impact, the full impact of counterparty risk. and the difference in views are not trivial. So there's substantial differences. Other banks may have less complicated balance sheets and don't have counterparty risk. I don't know. But I know for us that we can't come up with a precise number. But if we take our most conservative estimates on all of those variables, we could meet all of the rules on January 1, 2013, including advancing all the deductions, which I think would be a mistake, but you guys may get the regulator to do that eventually. We could do that and still have surplus capital, but we don't know how much surplus capital we have, and until we know that, I can't really answer your question of whether it's a constraint or not.
Okay, I hear you. Thanks. And I'll make this one hopefully much quicker. And lastly, for Bharat Masrani, I've certainly heard you on the fact that TD's loan growth has outperformed its peers, particularly over the last couple of years, and you showed us some good slides at the Investor Day that demonstrated that. You know, and it sounds like you're of the view that you're going to continue to do so in the near term. Just thinking not so much about TD's position in the U.S., just structurally right now with the consumer and commercial market in the U.S., what kind of system-wide loan growth is your team expecting for the U.S. in 2011?
Sumit, as we talked about at the Investor Day, we are seeing, we hope to see some firming in the market where generally the whole market goes up slightly. And as Ed mentioned, you know, we're getting some positive vibes from our clients on the ground that, you know, things appear to be stabilizing. So I do expect, you know, perhaps not as robust as one might want, but some growth in the market. In fact, I think a couple of the publications over the last week or so came out with some numbers that finally you're seeing some secular loan growth in the U.S. and the C&I book. So hopefully, you know, that's real. So I do expect the market either to stabilize or to grow slightly, and for us to outgrow whatever the market gives us.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Sumit. Operator, we'll take a few more questions, so can we move to the next question on the line, please?
Your next question comes from Brian Clark from KBW. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. On slide 32 of your presentation, you talk about, and I think you kind of highlighted this a little bit today, commercial real estate in the U.S. business. So we're seeing the gross impaired loans doubling in the office space and the $3.7 billion loan portfolio there for office. Can you give us a little color? Is that in one particular region you're seeing that? Or, you know, maybe just provide some color on that increase in the GILs there.
Yes, it's Mark. The office portfolio, I mean, we've looked at that. And it's really not concentrated in any a specific geographic region. It tends to be out of the central cores, which, generally speaking, in the last couple of years, it's been better to be outside the cores. So I really, you know, I wouldn't have anything more specific to add than that, other than it's not concentrated in a particular area or a particular type or to clients, and we're not really seeing anything unusual in it.
Okay. And just one quick question for Ed. You know, you mentioned a little bit about excess capital and deployment through acquisitions in the U.S. I mean, I guess there is quite a few U.S. banks that are still capital deficient. Do you see any opportunity? I mean, I guess when you're thinking about TSFG is now in and you're integrating that, how soon could you be back in the acquisition game, you know, if something came up?
I don't think we've changed our position from where we've been. I would say that there is sufficient uncertainty about the macroeconomic environment and the regulatory environment in the United States that we're probably still focused on small deals, not large deals. If there's something that was small came up that fitted our strategy, we thought we could make money on it, we do, but we're not anxious to do at this stage a large deal. Now, I'm probably not going to tell you, announce the moment when I change my mind and then go do a large deal, but you'll hear about it when I did it. But right now I can tell you that I'm not focused on doing a large deal.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for taking my questions.
Thanks, Brian. Operator, can we move to the next call, please?
Your next question comes from Mario Mendonca from Canaccord Genuity. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon. A question for Tim Hockey. But before I do, I just want to express my sort of almost shock that we're spending this much time talking about capital in Canada, just given everything that you hear about European banks. The fact that we're fussed about it just surprises me. But a question for Tim first. You talked about loan growth in Canada slowing to the mid-single digits by this time next year. Can I interpret that as meaning that you'd expect it to just gradually get there so that for all of 2011, you're still looking at maybe mid to high single-digit loan growth in Canada?
I'd say mid, fairly confident in 2011, absolutely right. Part of that is a function of our the economic growth, and frankly, part of it is an assumption we will continue to gain market share in both business and personal lending.
And perhaps, maybe this is a bit of a softball, but do you subscribe to the view that TD can continue to take market share in 2011 simply because of the scale and service arguments?
Let's see. What should my answer be? How about absolutely?
So if the industry is, because the industry is talking mid-single digits, so that's why I'm a little surprised you would stick with mid-single digits and not think of something a little higher than that.
Maybe it has to do with the assumption as to what the underlying economic growth is. I believe we'll beat the market, and that's about what our forecast would be. They might have a different view of underlying growth.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Operator, can we please take the next question?
Your next question comes from Brad Smith from Stonecap Securities. Please go ahead.
Thanks very much. Just a quick question. I hate to do it to you, Mario, on capital. But the issue that I would just like to address is the capital logged in your U.S. subsidiaries. You know, if we look at their call reports at the operating TD Bank NA, I see over $25 billion of capital. When I look at your supplementary package, I see just under $18 billion of capital being used to calculate the ROIC. Just wondering if someone could explain what the difference is and where it arises in the sub pack.
Well, essentially, Brad, it's Colleen. It doesn't. You don't see it in the supplementary because, frankly, we can downstream capital all day long to the United States, and there are certain different rules in the U.S. In relation to how much capital we have to hold for various types of criticized or classified assets, and we obviously hold the appropriate levels in the U.S. But that essentially doesn't affect our capital at the top of the house. So what you're looking at in the segment itself is you're looking at the invested capital, which is essentially all of the original goodwill and intangibles, plus then the operating capital that we need to run the business. And that's how we're measuring invested capital for the U.S.
Thank you, Colleen. Can you just explain, though, where the $25 billion comes from in the operating subsidiary, please?
Well, again, it's essentially, you know, it can be funding that we downstream from Canada.
Funding that you downstream from Canada.
Yeah, this essentially becomes capital in the U.S.
It becomes converted then.
Correct.
It's a debt funding that gets converted
it
to equity capital in the U.S. subsidiary.
Yeah, essentially you can, you know, again, whether it's capital that we've raised or whether it's debt, it qualifies as capital in the United States.
And does that contribute to the relatively low tax rate that you report in the segment?
The tax rate is the lower rate is due to a tax structure that we have, and that does affect our capital at the holdco level, not at the operating company level.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for your time. That's the end of the Q&A session. So with that, let me turn it over to Ed for final remarks.
Very simply, we thought 2010 was just a bang-up year. I think we went into 2010 nervous about the environment. It turned out that our decision to be very aggressive and go out there and serve our clients and customers turned out to be a great decision for our clients and customers and, frankly, a great decision for our businesses and allowed us pretty well across the board to take market share. And as I indicated, while we look at 2011 and we see a pretty tough operating environment in terms of the global economic situation and some of the regulatory headwinds, on the ground, we feel very good about how our businesses are positioned and are getting very positive feedback of what we were able to accomplish in 2011. All of this, just to say it again, is because we got 81,000 people that get up every morning and worry about the shareholder and the customers, and they're doing a great job. Thank you very much.
With that, I'll end the meeting. If you have any further questions, I'd encourage you to contact the Investor Relations team. Thanks for your time today, and we wish you a happy holidays.